Welcome to Tech Theater Clubhouse Conversations, where we have conversations around conversations about the conversations we just had on the Clubhouse app.
This is a podcast to continue that conversation. Every Tuesday on Clubhouse, we have really, really great discussions with brilliant people who sit at the intersection of technology and theater.
And we always walk away from those Clubhouse talks with so many more thoughts than we have time to get to. So we decided to share those, reach even more of y'all through this podcast. So let's get going. I am Jess, CEO and co-founder of Broadway Unlocked, and my background's in the theater. But I love connecting it to technology and the internet and all that jazz.
And I'm Joe, co-founder of Broadway Unlocked. I've been building and operating startups for over 10 years, and I try to bring a tech and media perspective to these conversations.
And so with that, welcome to Tech Theater. This week on Clubhouse, we talked about American Utopia and the American Theater article that talked through their approach to avoiding COVID closures, which, like, if you follow the theater side of tech and theater, you probably are very aware that all of Broadway is just like going down one by one. So that was a really exciting article to discuss. What did you say, Lucy? You were reclaiming Breakthrough? Was that it?
Oh, Breakthrough. It's a Breakthrough bright spot in all of the closure news.
So good. It really was. So we talked about that. And that kind of led us through to another conversation that's applicable to other Broadway shows, just in talking about Clyde's at Second Stage, starring Uzo Aduba and Ron Cephas Jones, and the future of live streaming and theater, because of course tonight they start their 2-week live stream run, which I believe is the first live streamed run of a Broadway show in history. And we just spent a lot of time talking about, you know, how best to allow shows to continue to reach new audiences, provide more accessibility in all of the different ways that we define accessibility, because that's a big word, and a lot of other really cool stuff around that. So, Joe, where do you want to start today? A lot of good stuff here.
I would love to start and go back to David Byrne's American Utopia and that wonderful breakthrough positive. Am I using that correctly, Lucy?
So, first, you're a big David Byrne fan, right?
I was just going to like play the game of like, Jess, I don't know if you know this about me. Jess definitely knows this about me. That I love any and all things David Byrne. I came to it like kind of late in life, learned of, you know, David Byrne and went back through the back catalog of Talking Heads and then just was like, oh, this guy is wild and so creative. And now just anytime he does anything, I'm like, sure, sign me up. Like, this color guard thing he did with a bunch of high schools around the country. Like, yep, no idea what this is. Let's do it. Or like when Here Lies Love, this like live concept album about Imelda Marcos, the former first lady of the Philippines, was brought to, I think it was like the Public.
The Public.
Yeah. I was like, yep, sign me up. I'm in. Like, this is weird. This is great.
Was that at Joe's Pub first? I think it was, maybe it was at Joe's Pub first and then Public.
No idea. But so I just will like, I will go anywhere he tells me to go. Have seen American Utopia, saw a live version of it back in like 2017 before it came to Broadway, like all over that stuff. Loving it.
So you're not biased is what you're saying for this conversation?
Not biased at all. Although I do want to take it both directions because I'm like, yes, hell yeah. Like, if there is a single person who's going to make something like this work in the face of COVID when half the musicians or whatever, like, test positive and they have to change the entire structure of the show, like, in a few days just to have it go back up, like, of course it's going to be him and the people that sort of flock to him to do and create art with him. Like, who else would it be? Like, that's just, like, I feel like how he thrives is on doing things that are either unexpected or seemingly impossible or at the very least just like weird and out of the ordinary. So this like didn't surprise me at all that he was like, we'll figure it out. It'll be weird. It'll be great. We'll figure it out. And I'm like so glad, Luce, that you brought this article to us and we got to talk about it because of course they figured it out.
You said you wanted to go two ways, right?
Yeah. So the other way I want to go was as I was reading through this first on Clubhouse, it gave me that feeling when you see like, you know, someone will tweet about like, oh, this amazing little kid like raised a whole bunch of money for his mom's surgery. And everyone's like, oh my God, you're amazing. And then inevitably someone quote tweets that tweet being like, this isn't a success story. This is a horrible failure of our society that this kid has to fundraise with a lemonade stand to pay for his mother's surgery, whatever, whatever, whatever. And I got that feeling inside of this article where I was like, this is like a good thing in the sense that like David Byrne and this crew of people like worked extra, extra hard and during the holidays and like figured out how to do this seemingly impossible thing. But that like they were set up to fail, which allowed them to then succeed and allows us to now praise them for succeeding. And sort of, I enjoy praising the individual, but I kept feeling that like systemic failure around all of this, whether it be COVID testing more broadly and COVID generally. So, you know, can't fully blame COVID, but you can blame like the United States response to COVID in putting them in a position to have to go above and beyond just to survive. And it just got me thinking about like, we as like a society and a culture love to laud the individuals that like succeed in the face of adversity. And we spend very little time talking about how the systems that we build create that adversity. And like, it makes me want to think more about, focus on, talk more about like, oh, how can a system be created that empowers a brilliant individual? And so there's like 100 David Byrnes doing awesome things versus one broken system that someone accidentally succeeds out of. So that was the other lens I was feeling as I was reading through this article. I was like, love that they succeeded, hate that they were forced into a weird situation where only David Byrne could succeed.
Well, I will say, to stand up a little bit for theater, though this particular instance is so COVID specific, that happens a lot in theater. Like, you just never know it, you know, like if thinking about sets falling apart or I did a show once. I mean, this is only my own experience, obviously, but like, where they had to fire an actor at the last minute and I wasn't even in the show. And I just like learned, you know, so I feel like that, I will say, I think it's important to like say that the spirit of art making and problem solving is strong in the theater, even outside of COVID times. This is a mess and completely out of scope, you know, in terms of pressure for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm with you. I feel like a lot of the best art, most impressive things come out of problem solving. I'm like, all right, how do we raise everyone's boats, right? A tide that raises all boats, whatever that saying is, so that the problems that we're solving and the you know, situations that we're getting into, and maybe applies a little bit less to, you know, a Broadway show, which is already sort of like, these people are fine. Like, they're not going to starve if the show, well, maybe they would. I don't actually know well enough. David Byrne is not going to starve if the show doesn't go on. The sort of the tide that raises all boats, so the problems that are being solved and the challenges being addressed and met by these amazing individuals are, you know, not just for survival, but are like pushing us forward and into new, weird, interesting places, and aren't just like, oh no, we're going to literally die if we don't solve this problem, so let's do that. Like, as a society, I feel like that should be amongst our like top goals, is the health and success of every, you know, citizen inside of said society.
Yeah. Well, something you just said too reminds me of something we never got around to, but kind of talked around-ish on Clubhouse today, which is, you were just saying, like, if you're on Broadway, you're probably going to be okay. And then we retracted and said, well, David Byrne's going to be okay. And we were talking a little bit about the money of Broadway today. But one aspect that I kind of just skimmed over in my brain, and I don't know why, is that, like, technically, it's so important in this instance that they figure, or could be so important that they figured out how to get American Utopia back up. Because, for instance, the Mrs. Doubtfire cast, we were talking today, they've gone on a 9-week hiatus to try to save the show, basically, because the producers on record saying that if they kept it running at the current capacity, they'd be closed inside of 3 weeks. So they're trying to wait out this surge of Omicron. But that means, so anybody who's on, I don't know what the deal is with Equity for these closures, right? So I'll preface this with saying, I assume Equity's going to ink some kind of agreement where they get some money during the furlough. But if you take that piece away for a second, you go from the minimum, the pink contract is $2,000 a month, a week, sorry, a week. No. Yeah, I think that's right. I have to double check that. It's a lot of money to making $300 a week, $465 on unemployment. Like, if you don't have money saved, which most actors don't have the ability to do because you don't have a long enough string of gigs that pay that well, like, what do you do when you go from making $2,000 a week to $2,500, probably closer to that now, to $465? What do you do?
Yeah, that's a huge swing into like dangerous territory if you do not have a bunch of money in the bank or family money or any of these other sort of safety nets that could in theory exist, which honestly in my mind just takes me back to yeah, the rising tide to lift all boats. Like, why should anyone have to like face that question and be like, oh, I lost my source of income due to, you know, means completely outside of my control, and now I'm completely fucked because I haven't been born into wealth, or I haven't like saved a whole bunch of money, which, you know, has an opportunity cost associated with it. Maybe they would have never made it to New York if they were saving money, things like that. So they were like fighting for survival. Keeping this show on mm-hmm. was helping them to continue to get that paycheck.
Mm-hmm. And I think that really plays into something we've talked about a couple of times, which is like amongst, I've caught myself saying this kind of recently a lot across, I'm like not a like life's not fair kind of person. I don't really believe in blaming things on things being fair or not fair. But like this epidemic feels really, really fucking unfair to the arts. And one piece of that, or one facet of that, that I think about when I listen to you talk about these endemic systematic issues is that, you know, we, because artists very frequently look middle class and make the thing, do the thing they love for their living, it is not as sexy to talk about the way in which they're marginalized, artists as a class, right? As a creator class. And that's part of what feels really just horrible about this is like, there's no news item on the fact that one industry in the entire world is now like now down, completely closed, right? Again, twice. Like the first time everyone lost their jobs, like every single fucking person that was an onstage arts worker lost their job. And that didn't happen in any other industry in that way. And now it's happening again. And these are folks that don't have often a ton of money saved because of the way we are treated in our, you know, across jobs. Broadway is a great job. It's highly unionized, but that's it. That doesn't really exist in that way across any other theater art work for an actor. So I don't know. It makes me upset. Like, I feel like we should be talking about that right now.
Yeah, it's wild that there isn't, or there probably are like small pieces inside of publications like American Theater, mm-hmm. But you know, like industry focus, more niche in the grand scheme of things, and maybe a Planet Money podcast every here and again. But yeah, it doesn't crest the sort of broader news ecosystem in the same way that other things that maybe aren't as far-reaching or irrelevant. Like, I feel like there's like a dissociation from the arts and people who don't like consider themselves to be part of, inside of, or artists generally. Like, there's a lot of people who consume art, but mm-hmm. like see themselves as separate from or outside of it. And therefore, like the concerns inside of art, big air quotes now, because that doesn't mean anything, but that they're dissociated from what's happening inside of the arts, and therefore the people inside of the arts that actually help to create all that stuff that they then ultimately consume. Mm-hmm. I feel like especially with the internet, as like the barriers to creation have been reduced so low, and now many more people have been able to sort of enter the sphere of being an artist via YouTube, Instagram, all these other platforms, that it's like devalued the work of the artist, or not the work of, but like it's devalued it in a bit in the eyes of just like the arts consumer of like, oh, that's easy. I could in theory do that, or I don't have to worry about or consider this class because the content just keeps coming, I think is kind of where my head is wrapping around to on it.
But I wonder then, that feels a little like Sisyphean to me, because I feel like theater, artists in that way have always been treated that way, not just now, like when it's so easy to consume art. So maybe we're just like looking for another excuse to continue to sort of be like, I don't have to worry about artists, you know, because it's not like this is new for at least theater, which is the only thing I can really speak as an authority on.
Yeah, no, makes sense. And maybe it's even just like an acceleration of the trend that was already existing, like you're saying, because nothing is new and everything's a remix.
That's true. I want to make sure we end on the breakthrough bright spot and not on a bummer. So I will say, I wish that I had gotten to see, they've already happened, right? These American Utopia shows he redid, they already happened. I wish I'd gotten to see them.
I think they're done. Yeah. They'll be doing 3 more days through January 2nd. So I think missed the final 3 days.
I want to be really clear in setting my intentions here to the universe that I do not want to see it bad enough for them to have to do the same thing over again, because that's terrible. But I really wish I had gotten to see it. And I really, I find myself more and more, it's kind of alluding to this in Clubhouse today, as a theater creator, finding myself much more interested in creating work like American Utopia that's more flexible, that has more room to be spontaneous or to be trans-platform or whatever it is. And so I just like was incredibly inspired by this.
Yeah, and I think that's like a positive story to your ability to see this show, whether it comes back in some form on Broadway or somewhere else, because it's an amazing show. And I'm sure they'll still do some version of it, whether it's, you know, in live concert form or if it's back in some theater setting. Yeah, it'll be back in some form and you'll be able to see it. And I'll come with you because I want to see it again.
Yeah, it was real, real good. What else was on your mind today when we were in Clubhouse?
I was actually thinking about sort of the resilience that you were just talking about with a show like American Utopia, and that it was, I mean, like most, if not all shows, yeah, fact check me on this, but that like no show just starts for the first time ever on Broadway. Like they're all workshopped in other places and people mess around with them. And then once they have sort of the built-in audience or demand, or, you know, someone can justify basically putting it on Broadway and believing that they'll make their money back, that's when it finally reaches like the level, the threshold that is Broadway. And so using American Utopia as the example, like it was a bunch of talking head songs that were then concerts, that was then like this touring act that then kind of turned into what is the Broadway show. And it is, like you were describing, like a more resiliently designed show. Like they had the ability, based on the way that the show was structured, to do this craziness that was, you know, outlined in the American Theater article, to rejigger it and make it work despite the fact that a bunch of the performers could no longer actually be part of the show because of COVID. And so it got me thinking more about like, okay, the like experimentation that we talk about often and that we get excited about, and the idea of like a more resilient designed sort of live performance, live show, like will not start with Broadway, like at all shows. And that's where I wanted the fact check. Has there ever been a show? Sidebar. Has there ever been a show that just like premieres straight to Broadway?
Yeah, but it's like 0.5% of, I made that up, just all y'all who are listening, but it's very small percent.
Fact checking me with made up facts.
Yep, exactly.
I think we looked this up one time.
We did.
One that I remember was that Spider-Man was one of the shows opened straight to Broadway.
Yeah. All right. Julie Taymor has the plot.
Well, I think that is to what you just said. I was thinking about this today in Clubhouse. I think your instinct is spot on. I do believe that there are like the David Byrnes of the world. Like there is going to, as soon as this dam actually breaks and it's not so freaking difficult to, you know, put an agreement in front of people that allows cameras, which is coming soon, obviously. I think it will start on Broadway, but with just a couple of, you know, like the David Byrnes of the world, people that they already trusted, the fun family, you know what I mean? Producers, they already know, but who have enough clout and power to force them to like go for something like that. But I agree with you that the majority of that work is going to happen outside of Broadway. And I was thinking about that today. I was like, oh my God, I hope this year brings, like, I hope in the evenings I'm going to direct workshop readings of shows made for stage and screen. Like, and it's going to be all small creators, right? All the people with the big ideas and the gumption to get them done and the literacy with technology. And they'll find their audiences or they won't. And in a couple of years, there'll be a pathway for those shows to come to Broadway, I think.
Yeah, and Broadway will be brought kicking and screaming if they must by the fact that people will want it, and there will be proof points and ticket sales. And like it felt almost like freeing a bit to be like, all right, fuck Broadway for a little while. Like they can keep mucking about in whatever way they feel like and whatever they want to. And mostly, you know, I don't know, they're very risk averse, I think is
very
how I would put it.
Like,
incredibly risk averse. Yeah. They need to make back their money. They're very profit driven, yada, yada, yada.
Which, by the way, pause, is hilarious since, like, what's the statistic? 50% of Broadway shows or more don't make their money back? Like, no one makes money on Broadway. But go on.
Yeah. But so, like, that we can, you know, uncouple ourselves from Broadway for a little bit and get our heads out of that chaos zone, because it feels like it is like a chaotic world. The more I learn about it, the more I'm like, oh my goodness, this whole world is so confusing and so chaotic and so unwilling to change and adapt and innovate. So let's put them aside for a little bit. Let's go work with the New York Theater Workshops and the other sort of like, yeah, any place and any set of creators who are like, this is a cool opportunity to reach more people. And it hasn't yet been proven, right? The ticket sale numbers aren't technically there yet.
Yeah.
But as Jermaine was saying across the Clubhouse show, he's like, I would have been one of those kids. Like, I would have been one of those people that wants to watch the show and then still would have gone in person once I could physically get to New York City. But he would have bought one of those tickets. And it's finding the right price point. It's finding the right business model. It's finding the right creators to create the art that makes sense inside of the medium that is live streamed. And it's definitely not starting on Broadway.
No. And just to like wrap it back around to your original point about systems, broken systems, and not to be a womp womp, but like, I don't even think most of it starts on New York Theater Workshop, and we don't get to work on it at institutions. Those are going to be artists that are already in their pipeline. You know, they don't, theater doesn't, for the most part, really value our, like, you know, our company's experience. And I straddle the line too much between an artist and an entrepreneur. So to bring it all back, it's like, though, it's going to start with individual theater makers and people like me and them working 12 hours a day and then going to a rehearsal afterwards for a reading you're doing for free, you know? And I mean, for me, like, that's sort of like what oils my engine. So like, it's exciting, but to your, you know, the point you were making earlier, it's not particularly equitable or just for anybody, because we have to do it on our own for free.
Yeah. Well, going back to, you know, universal basic income, which is basically what I was alluding to earlier.
Oh, really?
Like if you didn't worry about paying your rent and eating food, throwing all your time at interesting and creative problems like this that then ultimately benefit the Broadways of the world by helping them reach more audiences and charging them probably too much for a live stream ticket.
Yeah.
Like, it's got to start somewhere. And back to universal basic incomes. I feel like we've talked about that in the past on the podcast.
You do bring it up a lot.
I like the idea. Ooh, this is an interesting idea here. Free idea alert. We need that as a segment. Give us a sound, Luce. we throw out a lot of good
free
ideas.
It's true.
Yeah. But we were talking earlier about like what could work revenue model wise for a live stream, because an individual ticket to a single show is maybe not the right way. It works for an in-person theater experience. It may not work the same. It may not have the same draw. It may not bring in the same ticket price in a sustainable way. So like, what are the other ways that we can do it? And one of the ones we were noodling on was this idea of like a live stream subscription to the theater. And like, they just have a camera on at all times and you can tune into it whenever you want. You can join any show that you want that is always live streamed. And so it like brings in a more sustainable like line of revenue. You know, you're paying, getting monthly subscribers to, is it to the Guthrie? Is it to an individual show? I don't really know yet, but say a regional theater with some cachet decides like, okay, we're going to invest in live streaming and we're going to do it one by installing a bunch of cameras in our place and just like committing to turning them on all the time. But then the other is to like bring in the creators to be like, hi, we want to do a program, an incubator of sorts that actually brings these people in specifically to use the technology that they've just been like spending all the money, time, energy installing. And it's like, hey, here, go wild with it, get crazy, do some fun things. Like, we'll sort of like ride the audiences a little bit that you've built across digital media in the past 2 years, kind of empower you and enable you with our physical space, our other resources, a la like, you know, Maker Studios back in the day, the artist creators coming together to share resources and, you know, push the medium forward. You know, the theater takes the risk on, will those audiences be there? The creator takes the risk on sort of like shacking up a bit with an institutional property that they now have to like share rights with. I don't actually know how that's going to work. But that seems like a gamble worth taking if, you know, you're got some COVID funds or something like that and you're trying to decide what the future looks like for your regional theater.
That's kind of what Oregon Shakespeare Festival is doing with their, did we talk about that on here? I know one of the associate producers, and he was just sharing with me that they, the money they make on Sweat, which is a Lynn Nottage play, as well as Clyde's, because Sweat went to Broadway, provides them an income stream that, and they chose to do pretty much exactly what you just described, Joe, with it, which is to make a mandate to develop, be a like proactive part of developing new media work and investing in the equipment and the audiences, hopefully building the audiences and bringing in creators. So they just finished a festival called... Ah, son of a bitch. I can't remember what it's called.
Son of a bitch is a great name for a festival.
Yeah, that would be my festival. It literally just finished and I didn't get to see anything.
Oh, I have another thing to throw in while you're looking, which is a la something that I learned from you via Erykah Badu when she was doing her live stream stuff during the pandemic, mm-hmm. where she would like blast out around her social channels, be like, what's up? A live thing is happening literally right now. Like, mm-hmm. join. Mm-hmm. I want that to be like a tactic inside of this idea that I'm throwing around. So Oregon Shakespeare Theater, Oregon Shakespeare Festival, what is it?
It's called, yeah, the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Quills Fest. So they just launched their first two-day immersive digital event, Quills Fest, in November, at the end of November. And it was a series of visuals and conversations meant to introduce online streaming audience members to what's involved in the constantly evolving technological elements of today's artistic crossroads where live theater and extended virtual reality intersects. So it's specifically, you know, focused on virtual reality, but I think they're really kind of the first ones out, like making a significant investment in what you just suggested, which is exciting.
Yeah, that's really cool. All right, go them.
Yeah, I feel like as we start to round up, this is an unanswered question to pose. But you know what we were talking about in Clubhouse today? There's a blending of the lines, right? Like theater is now being influenced by creator culture and stories that, you know, transverse platforms and like people like Justin TV we were talking about today on Clubhouse, who just like carried a camera around and streamed themselves 24 hours a day and made a shit ton of money. And theater can't, you know, can't possibly be influenced by that, but also doesn't quite know what to do with it yet, you know? And I feel like there's a connection in something that I was thinking about at the end of today, which is, and this is something I had chatted with my brother about last year, which is that, like, I'm going to use me as the example, but I think this is a bigger question. I spent my career avoiding institutions, right? Like, literally made every choice possible to not go work at an institution because I've always wanted to make the things without rules that I don't understand, to your point about the chaos of the theater industry or the commercial theater industry. And then for the last 2 years, that's all we've done is work inside the industry and the institutions. And I'm really proud of the movement forward we've helped to drive, the understanding we've helped to carve. But I definitely, as I said earlier, find myself really wanting to do more work back outside of them. And like you're just saying, you know what I mean, with individual creators and being able to make something fresh for this new paradigm rather than make something that's responsive to all the rules, challenges, and issues in the paradigm. But here's where I think the connection lies. It's like, what happens in a modern society when the lines are also being blurred between an artist and an entrepreneur? Because art's so territorial, mm-hmm. about artists working on things. But like for us, you and I, right? We're like entrepreneurs and artists, and that means we don't get either of those identities solely. So to go to, like, I don't know, Quill Fest, which I have no, you know, I don't know anything about VR really, so I'm not qualified. I'll just use it as an example to say I'm interested in directing and creating something from scratch is harder because I'm the CEO of a company, right? Mm-hmm. Or for someone to listen to these amazing ideas you're throwing out right now on this podcast is harder for art because you're not an artist, big air quotes again, like you said. So I'm curious, like, how that's gonna tumble out. Like, will we even be able to do the thing you said earlier, which is to start working with smaller, more nimble, future thinking folks in addition to institutions?
I bet you there's a solution somewhere on the blockchain.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Half joking, half serious.
Oh my God.
But definitely no answers to be found here yet. But keep coming back and listening to this show because we might figure out the answer.
Maybe we will. Time. We'll certainly let you know how we go at trying.
But in the meantime, we'd love to hear what you think. You can join us on Twitter to get in this conversation, share your ideas, and let me know what you think about this brilliant idea for regional theaters to basically create an incubator program for artists, which is already happening, as we've noticed. So hit us up at BWI Unlocked on Twitter. Use the hashtag TechTheaterCH and share your thoughts.
And of course, come be a part of our next conversation, please, on Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on Clubhouse. You can raise your hand, jump in, and share your thoughts.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, we'd love it if you could rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review.
Every single topic we talked about has been inspired by the articles we read and share in our company Slack channel every week and the people who join our stage on Clubhouse. So like we said, tweet us at hashtag TechTheaterCH, share some cool articles with us, leave us a review if you're feeling feisty, and we'll see you next week.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.